All right, welcome again to the series The Presidents and the Jews, part 19 tonight, discussing the presidency of Dwight David Eisenhower, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. Eisenhower was the 34th president, and he was the last president, the last person elected president, having never held a political office before. There have not been many people who even run for office, run for the presidency, never having held elected office before. We've had some this time. The only one I can think about in the interim who was a serious candidate for a short time was Steve Forbes in 1996. But this year, of course, there's been two, Ben Carson and, what's his name? Oh, Donald Trump, right. Of course, the difference between Eisenhower and all the others who never held political office before was that he happened to be the victorious general in World War II. And he later said, when he asked about this, there's no more political organization in America than the American military. Well, the good thing about a general is that he knows to give orders and have them carried out. The bad thing about being a president, he said, or general who became the president, is that you still know how to give orders, but there's little recourse when they're not carried out, which is very frustrating, humbling, and unnerving. The relationship of Dwight Eisenhower to the Jewish people was always a bit strained. Now, he was, in effect, the liberating general of some of the concentration camps, and we'll see, he's the one who ordered military cameramen to film everything because he said one day, soon, no one will believe this took place. He was also the one who, on site, had to deal first with the Jewish survivors of the Holocaust. And I can't help believe that that colored his relationship with Jews, seeing Jews as helpless victims who always needed some benefactor to make decisions for them and bail them out, shaped the way he understood the state of Israel. I think probably made him see Israel as something less than an independent state that can make its own decisions. Some of the most challenging and tense moments between Jews, Israel, and the United States took place during his administration. It didn't help, in fact it never helps, that Jews did not vote for him, notwithstanding his status as liberator. And the Jewish voting record here, we'll see, was almost a mirror image of the national voting record. How it came to all these stressful situations and the modern lessons we can learn from them are all part of the Dwight David Eisenhower story, who's known to all as Ike. Eisenhower was ridiculed in his time for mediocrity, but he, like Truman, has also fared well in retrospect. It took only a few decades, and then people look back on the 50s with nostalgia. An America that was prosperous, peaceful, civilized, and happy. What's the classic show of the 1950s? Happy Days. It came out 20 years later, but Happy Days was Happy Days compared to the turbulence. Amos and Andy? I don't think so. Compared to the turbulence of the 1960s and the discontent of the 1970s, the 50s were a glorious time in American life. The last decade, really until today, without national strife, without polarization, before the national moral decline set in, and Eisenhower, who was much more engaged than people gave him credit for, accomplished this by focusing on things that made people's lives better. For one, the interstate highway system, and avoiding things that would cause acrimony, like prosecuting the Cold War militarily, as many people, many of his supporters in 1952 thought he would do, liberate Eastern Europe militarily. They thought he would be a gung-ho warrior. And in fact, he was the exact opposite. I think he only sent troops into battle once. Not even battle. But aside from Korea, from which he soon withdrew American troops, he sent American troops to Lebanon in 1958 to quell a civil war. Other than that, didn't happen. So he did not prosecute the Cold War in any vigorous way, nor did he force desegregation on people. Eisenhower did not even get involved in school desegregation that was mandated by the Supreme Court in the Brown versus Topeka Board of Education decision, which, by the way, he opposed. And he tried to influence Warren at a dinner before the decision was rendered, and it was a unanimous decision not to rule in such a way that would rile up the South. The sole exception was 1957 in Little Rock, Arkansas, when the school district refused to implement the desegregation ruling, and Eisenhower was sent to the National Guard and the 101st Airborne Division to enable 9 black students to attend an all-white high school. But he was not an activist on either front, which is why blacks, until today, are less nostalgic about the 1950s than are whites. Part of the wistfulness for that era was the stability. Again, America was coming off a time. Roosevelt served forever. Truman succeeded him. Eisenhower was the first president to govern all 50 states. Hawaii joined while he was president. But he was the last president until Reagan to serve 2 consecutive terms. That's a lot, meaning his 5 successors did not serve 2 consecutive terms. Killed, voted out, resigned, etc. And he was known also for his easygoing manner, his love of golf, which he played very frequently. To date, he remains the only president ever to shoot score a hole-in-one. Didn't happen while he was president, but 1968, nonetheless. And oil painting. He even had a studio in the White House, both of which contributed to his reputation as a laid-back, even absentee president. The truth is, he wasn't absentee at all, although he was a little laid back. Eisenhower was one of the few presidents to use the hammer against Israel, to make threats, either directly or through surrogates, against Israel, against American Jewry, and he's therefore not remembered altogether fondly by Jews. Arguably, he was the worst president for Israel until the incumbent, even worse than Carter or Bush the First, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. Dwight David Eisenhower was born in Texas in 1890, but his parents very soon moved to Abilene, Kansas. He was an infant, and he was thereafter identified with Abilene, where he's buried, his presidential library is located. His family was of German origin. His great-great-great-grandparents having emigrated from Karlsbrunn in the 1740s, but we see a pattern, as was a common claim in that era. Eisenhower was accused of being Jewish by Jew haters. Happened while he was in the military, happened, we'll see, when he was in North Africa, happened in Europe, the Nazis made the same accusation, and happened when he ran for president. The name David, of course, is a biblical name, but his father's name was David Jacob Eisenhower. David Yaakov sounds even more Jewish, but he was actually, his family were Jehovah's Witnesses, and he became a Presbyterian. There's no Jewish blood in him at all. By his own admission, he never met a Jew as a child. He only knew of the Jews through the Bible. His mother was an inveterate Bible reader. Eisenhower was quite familiar with the Bible, so he told Abba Ibn once that growing up, he assumed that Jews were, what he called Israelites, were an extinct species, that they now all dwelled in heaven. And he thought that, I quote, until I came to New York and I found out how wrong I was, that he found Jews. He had a middle-class upbringing, emphasis on values and faith and hard work, self-reliance. In fact, part of the appreciation or criticism, the disparagement of Eisenhower is that he was middle of the road in everything. He was an average student. He was average height, 5'9", average weight. He had a pleasant personality, a very nice smile, pleasant personality. He scored well enough to be admitted to West Point, where he was part of an amazing class of 1915, from whom 64 generals would emerge from a class of 164, including 2 4-star generals, Eisenhower and Omar Bradley, was his classmate. He graduated 61st. The guy's right in the middle, you know, towards the bottom, the middle third, at the top of the middle third. He was career military, but he never saw combat. World War I ended before he was ready. And through the 1920s, he served in a variety of administrative posts, served very ably, was promoted and promoted and promoted. He graduated first in his class at the Command and General Staff Training School in 1926, and he served under legends. He served under John Blackjack Pershing, served under Douglas MacArthur, served under George Marshall for a time. He served in the Panama Canal Zone and the Philippines. That's, in fact, where he first encountered Jews when he was in the Philippines in the 20s under MacArthur. He met Jews, 200 members of the Manila Jewish community. But he was a classic staff member, noted for his efficiency as well as his ability to get along with everyone. In the 1930s, he was tasked with planning for the next war, which means, well, you're not in combat again, you're really sitting behind a desk, but it means anticipating enemies, responses, logistics, etc. Government has, the military has staffs that do this work ad hayom. I mean, we know the plans in the drawer of the Pentagon, how to invade Canada, for one, still exists, but it does encroach on a person's military capabilities if he's not yet in combat. But in fact, he was chosen for his tasks in the war because he was a master at logistics, and he was very efficient. And in prosecuting the war, Roosevelt felt that would be the primary function of any commanding general. Eisenhower married Mamie Dowd in 1916. She was just 20 when they married, and one son who died at the age of 3 of scarlet fever, and they had only one surviving son, John, who himself became a brigadier general, graduated West Point on D-Day, as it turns out, and was a military historian. John's most famous child is his son David, who's another historian, in fact wrote a biography of his grandfather, after whom the presidential retreat Camp David was named. Eisenhower called it after David Eisenhower. Roosevelt had called it Shangri-La. And as we know, David Eisenhower married Nixon's daughter Julie. They got married in the White House during the Nixon administration. It was cute because Nixon was Eisenhower's vice president. Not so cute because Eisenhower did not really care for Nixon at all. He was gone, though. He was dead by the time his grandson married. World War II, when the Americans entered World War II in 1941, Eisenhower was serving on the staff in Washington, D.C. One of Hitler's fatal mistakes was declaring war on the U.S., even though the U.S. had only declared war on Japan as a result of Pearl Harbor. It's very intriguing. What if the great Roosevelt speech, December 8, 1941, and the congressional authorization for war only authorized war against Japan? Roosevelt didn't mention Germany at all. It was Germany. Hitler declared war on December 11th, and then Congress filed the declaration of war. In theory, there was no reason for it, and it's a terrible mistake that Hitler had made. Whatever Roosevelt's interests, Hitler plunged in, and he paid the price for it. In November 1942, Roosevelt appointed Eisenhower the Supreme Allied Commander for the invasion of North Africa. Operation Torch, with Eisenhower, successfully carried out. Why Eisenhower? For the reasons I mentioned. He was extremely organized, he was personable, he was modest, although decisive, and with a temper also, but he was also not yet overseas. He was still in D.C., so Roosevelt did not have to choose among fighting generals, elevating one over the others. In North Africa, Eisenhower dealt with the Nazi propaganda that he was a Jew, and this was the Nazis leafleted across North Africa, Algeria, etc. He was a Jew sent by the Jew Roosevelt to kill Arabs and give their land to the Jews, hoping to rile up the native Arab population. And this is critical as well. Eisenhower had the personality to navigate all the competing egos among the American and British generals, and later Charles de Gaulle as well. With the success of Torch, Eisenhower commanded the invasion of Sicily and then got the ultimate assignment, Supreme Head of the Allied Expeditionary Force in Europe, and he commanded the planning and execution of Operation Overlord, the invasion of Europe, D-Day. He was Roosevelt's choice over George Marshall. And this was an extraordinary undertaking. 160,000 soldiers scaling the cliffs of Normandy, and the planning, logistics, the uncertainty, the delay first because of the weather, the delay because of sudden bad weather, and then the almost hasty order into battle when there was a window, a meteorological window, despite the fear of impending bad weather. Eisenhower's charge to the troops on the day of battle is a classic, and I read it in part. Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, he meant the Soviets, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man-to-man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage and devotion to duty and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck. And let us beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking. That was the message, the charge to the troops when they left, they embarked on the ships to cross the channel. Less well known is Dwight Eisenhower's defeat speech, which was planned in case the D-Day invasion did not succeed. And he wrote a defeat speech, and he carried in his wallet as well. And I'll read it to you because it sheds a very positive light on his own personal virtues. I quote, "Our landings in the Cherbourg area have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I've withdrawn the troops. My decision to attack at this time and place was based on the best information available. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone." None of the, you know, mistakes were made. The passive voice. No comment because the matter is under investigation. No, he says, if it failed, the blame is mine. Personal responsibility. And the invasion could have been a disaster. Visit the beaches of Normandy, and you'll see how the Nazis were ensconced in fortified positions on the cliff, raining fire on wide expanses of open land. I found this lying around this afternoon. I picked up at Pointe du Hoc a few years ago, and you just see, if you look at the beaches, Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juneau, Sword, and Pointe du Hoc, there is high ground with an expansive beach, some places double from this wall to that wall. And the soldiers disembarked the ships, still in the water, defenseless, with Nazi machine guns raining down on them. Then they had to cross this open area, it's a beach, nothing, no tree, no fortification, no building, completely open, marching maybe between 50 and 150 yards to shelter, with that one famous group that Reagan memorialized in 1984, literally climbing the cliffs of Pointe du Hoc, climbing the cliffs and overcoming the Nazis there. In many places, the Germans were just overwhelmed by the sheer number of Allied soldiers. In some cases, they ran out of ammunition. There were more than 10,000 Allied casualties just on the first day, and only 1,000 German dead. If you think about it, if it had been televised, reported in real time, it would have been considered a catastrophe. And they would have called for Eisenhower's head and Roosevelt's head as well. But it succeeded. And less than a year later, Germany surrendered. By his own admission, Eisenhower hated the Germans, especially when he came into the area, the camps, for their brutality and their inhumanity. He even contemplated, he wrote this, just executing the entire German general staff, which is a few thousand people. He did not in the end. He did order American troops to visit the concentration camps. He himself went to Buchenwald in April 1945, right within days of liberation. And he wrote to George Marshall, and I quote, "The things I saw beggar description. In one room, the bodies of 20 or 30 naked men were piled up, killed by starvation. George Patton would not even enter. He said he would get sick if he did so. I made the visit deliberately to be able to give first-hand evidence of these things if ever in the future there develops a tendency to charge these allegations merely to propaganda." And Eisenhower ordered army photographers to film everything as evidence in war crimes trials. And because, he said, the day would come when people would deny these atrocities, not yet called the Holocaust, took place. And he wrote, he gave the order, "Get it all on record now. Get the films, get the witnesses, because somewhere down the track of history, some," and he used the pejorative word for person, "some person, some bum will get up and say that this never happened." That's why the films of the Holocaust are almost exclusively films of Buchenwald and Bergen-Belsen. There's the Soviets film very little from Auschwitz and nothing from any of the other camps. Those are the main camps that the Allies, the Americans especially, liberated, and it was filmed extensively. Eisenhower even forced German civilians to come and view the camps and the piles of bodies, and he forced the Germans to properly dispose of them as well. He also appointed a separate staff member named Judah Nadich, who was a conservative rabbi. He was the highest-ranking Jewish chaplain in Europe. He appointed Nadich as his personal staff member to monitor the welfare of the Jewish refugees in the DP camps. Nadich wrote a book in 1953 entitled Eisenhower and the Jews, in which he states that Eisenhower rejected a plan that was being thrust upon him that would have forced Jewish refugees to return to their pre-war homes in Europe. And Eisenhower even attended Yom Kippur davening in Feldafing in the fall of 1945. Nadich even brought Ben-Gurion to see Eisenhower in October 1945, introduced Ben-Gurion by saying to Eisenhower, if there was a Jewish state in Palestine, this is the prime minister. And Ben-Gurion remembered Eisenhower's cold fury to the horrors of Nazism. That's Ben-Gurion's words. After Nadich went back stateside, Eisenhower's Jewish advisor was Judge Simon Rifkin, later better known as the named partner of Paul Weiss Rifkin and a couple others. Eisenhower even sent military planes to Israel, the land of Israel, to bring back Hebrew books and teachers to the DP camps. Unfortunately, none of those planes carried refugees to Israel, which was the Allied policy. February 1947, Eisenhower kicked off the emergency UJA campaign for refugee relief. The goal was $170 million, and he told a Jewish audience, I quote, "Only one who has seen, as I have, the mental and physical effects of savagery, repression, and bigotry upon the persecuted of Europe can realize the full need for the material help and encouragement you propose to give." At the same banquet, Herbert Lehman, the former governor of New York, said that only the generosity of the Jews of the United States can help Jewish survivors in Europe through the phase of rehabilitation, reconstruction, and resettlement. And it was Lehman who urged that the land of Israel be open to the refugees for immediate settlement. Jews never forgot Eisenhower's role in liberation, and he was honored in 1955 while he was president with the UJA Lamp of Freedom, which I'm sure he treasured. Right after the war, Eisenhower was appointed military governor of the U.S. occupation zone. He returned to D.C. briefly to become the Army Chief of Staff, replacing Marshall. In 1948, he took the only private sector job he ever had, president of Columbia University, which he did not much enjoy. And he took a leave of absence from Columbia to become commander of NATO in late 1950. Another job awaited. In fact, when he began the campaign, that's when he finally resigned officially as president of Columbia. Now, Eisenhower was always coy about political office, even as he was first being mentioned for the presidency during World War II. He said, of course, that he never wanted it. His old friend George Patton reported that already in 1943, Ike wants to be president so badly you can taste it. Now, he was a cipher. Both parties recruited him. Several times, Truman met with Eisenhower to ask him to succeed him as the Democrat nominee. Eisenhower finally rebuffed Truman, and he said he and his family were all Republicans from way back. He put his name out there. He didn't want a campaign. He faced stiff competition from Senator Robert Taft of Ohio and also from MacArthur for a time. But he was enormously popular. MacArthur had been sacked by Truman as the general in Korea. Republicans, shut out of the White House for 20 years already, were salivating. And Eisenhower was essentially drafted for the nomination, ultimately winning a close vote on the first ballot. He was simply a middle of the roader around whom different factions could unite. And the Republicans did have different factions: isolationists versus interventionists, those who want to win the Cold War outright, and those who wanted some type of rapprochement with the Soviets. In the election, Eisenhower faced Senator Adlai Stevenson of Illinois, who, we don't know what's going to happen this summer in the Republican convention, but Stevenson was not even a candidate when the Democrat convention opened in Chicago. But he gave such a stirring and witty speech that delegates flocked to him, and the convention nominated John Sparksman for vice president. Now, Eisenhower's own vice presidential nominee was a young Californian senator named Richard Nixon, chosen because he was a staunch anti-communist. And there was a Joe McCarthy wing of the Republican Party that needed to be satisfied. Eisenhower himself had no use for McCarthy, but he shied away from criticizing him for purely political reasons. As is well known, Nixon ran into ethical problems during the campaign. Never after, just during the campaign. Eisenhower was tempted to sack him, but did not. And in response to the accusation, he was taking gifts, meaning bribes. Nixon gave the famous Checker speech on national television, redeeming himself in the process. And for decades, his speech was the most viewed television event of all time. Ike became a decent campaigner, known mostly for his infectious smile and the way he mangled the English language. And he had one of the most successful political slogans of all time: "I like Ike." You can't beat that. And Irving Berlin even wrote a song that I'm sure some of you remember. He was a big Eisenhower supporter. And Eisenhower was a close race for a time, but then he made the famous declaration a little over a month before the election, with the Korean War in a stalemate and Chinese troops by the millions fighting for the North. Eisenhower announced, "I shall go to Korea," which in the popular mind meant that he would win the war. But that's not what he said. He did go to Korea once. A month after the election, he saw that there was no chance for victory, and within 6 months of taking office, had negotiated an armistice treaty that ended the conflict and remains in effect until today. Why did the North concede, North Korea? Because there were voices in the administration that Eisenhower did not quell, calling for the use of the atomic bomb against North Korea just to end the war quickly. The atomic bomb still considered a viable option in those days. Well, at least now we know why North Korea, since then, has been interested in acquiring their own nuclear weapon. Eisenhower defeated Stevenson, a landslide, 55% to 44%. 39 states to 9. For the first time in decades, the Republicans made inroads in the South. If you look at the map, Stevenson won no state west of Missouri. That's a lot of America. It's a lot of red territory. Stevenson won the Jewish vote, 64-36%, which is odd in light of Eisenhower's wartime exploits, but Jews were now confirmed Democrats. Eisenhower was the oldest president elected since Buchanan. He was 62, and when he left office at age 71, no one that old had ever before been president, 71 years old. Reagan actually eclipsed that mark. He was 78 when he left office. But think about it. If Hillary Clinton wins, Rahman al-Islam, she'll be 69 when taking office. If Trump wins, Rahman al-Islam, he'll be 70. If Bernie Sanders wins, Rahman al-Islam, he'll be 75. Cruz is more common, although he's a little younger than the average. He'd be 46. It's a big gap. There's almost no one in the 50s and 60s running, the 50s being the most common age for people to run for president. Actually, many people in their 50s did run for president. Elliot's considering it also. But none of them succeeded. There's never been such a seamless transition, even though there was a change of parties, and even though Eisenhower and Truman did not really get along. Think about it. The cabinet was already in place and met with Eisenhower in New York a week before inauguration. That's hitting the ground running. Some of its members would be quite troublesome to Jews, and Eisenhower's term in office would be marked by these dust-ups. I should mention, one of his earliest decisions, Eisenhower refused to block the execution of convicted Soviet spies Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, sentenced to death in 1951, but still alive 2 years later when Eisenhower took office. That's not to say it was a big Jewish outcry to keep them alive, although they did have their defenders, but Eisenhower wrote to one Reform rabbi supporting them, "There are times when death is the only effective penalty." The Rosenbergs were electrocuted June 19, 1953, right before Shabbos. Interesting, in Sing Sing, they would execute people at 11 o'clock at night, now before midnight, and then someone said, "You can't do it, it's Shabbos, it has to be postponed another day." They said, "Okay, we'll do it before Shabbos." So they moved it up 3 hours to 8 o'clock, and they're buried in Wellwood Cemetery out in Pine Lawn. The most troublesome of the Eisenhower cabinet was the Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, who always suffered from two things aside from his distaste for Jews. Churchill referred to him as dull, duller, and Dulles. And Eisenhower, because of his life's experiences, fancied himself his own expert on foreign affairs and regularly sought to bypass him. And that's why Dulles found it necessary to assert himself sometimes in offensive ways. Eisenhower did use Dulles. Dulles's brother, Allen, was the CIA director at the same time. He used Dulles to convey difficult tidings to Jewish leaders, which he unfailingly did. Dulles, whatever his personal predilections towards Jews were, he felt that the national interests of the United States demanded that the United States side with the Arabs. They had the oil, they had dozens of countries that voted in the UN, and they had to be cultivated so as not to fall into the Soviet orbit. And he felt any type of kindness or concession shown to Israel, by definition, harmed American interests. It was Dulles who has a very unique claim to fame. He got tired of having to meet with every so-called Jewish leader of the endless number of Jewish organizations, and at his request and as a consequence, in 1956, the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, which is a redundancy, there being no minor Jewish organizations, they're all major, but it was formed in 1956 and remained until today. Truth be told, some of those organizations are organizations in name and on paper only. Ironically, the conference served to unite the Jewish people into speaking more frequently with one voice, which was not always the case before, and Dulles might have regretted his role in its founding. These two brothers, the Dulles brothers, fought the Cold War in their own way. They overthrew the elected president of Iran and installed the Shah, and that's brought up until today as well. They did much mischief in Europe. In Latin America, they fomented the rebellion in Hungary that would coincide with the crisis in Sinai in 1956. Interestingly, neither brother attended their sister's wedding when she married someone from an Orthodox Jewish family. Dulles took office in 1953, intending to separate the U.S. from Israel and Harry Truman's pro-Israel policies. In truth, it's been consistent since 1948, if not before. The State Department has consistently sought a policy of even-handedness, which in a Middle Eastern context always means pro-Arab. If Arabs want to destroy Israel, so what's even-handed? Destroy half of Israel? Certain things you can't compromise on. One of the reasons why AIPAC was founded was to serve as a counterforce to the antagonism towards Israel in the State Department, that counterforce being AIPAC's specialty, Congress. And they became Israel's lobby in Congress. Even though AIPAC was founded in 1951, it came into its own during the Eisenhower administration under the leadership of its founder, Cy Kennan, and began the practice of having congressmen write and pressure the administration to pursue pro-Israel policies and ameliorate anti-Israel policies. Now, much of Eisenhower's lack of sympathy for Israel as a nation or the Jewish state stemmed from the fact that most of the Jews of his acquaintance were not Zionists. In fact, there was an organization called the American Council on Judaism. It was mainly Reform Jews, was anti-Zionist, completely secular, very influential, even though it had barely 16,000 members. But that became the organization. In a memo Eisenhower sent to Dulles in October 1953, Eisenhower wrote, I quote, "The political pressure from the Zionists in the Arab-Israeli controversy is a minority pressure. My Jewish friends tell me that except for the Bronx and Brooklyn, the great majority of the nation's Jewish population is anti-Zion." That's what Eisenhower wrote to Dulles. Whether that is true or not numerically, it's not as important as the fact that this was Ike's perception, and an accurate one. Most Jews of his acquaintance were not Zionist. American Jewry was not Zionist, except in a very tepid sense. Think about it. Anybody make a big deal at Yom HaTzmaut in the 1950s? Was there a salute to Israel parade in the 1950s? The first was not till 1964. And all these became more popular after the Six-Day War. But now, less than a decade after the Holocaust, American Jews were still in hibernation, not yet grappling with their failures during the Holocaust, still insecure about being perceived as good Americans. So Zionism and support for Israel outside a small activist contingent was very low-key. So even if Eisenhower was wrong on the numbers and most Jews were supportive of Israel, he was right on the politics. So the goal of Jewish activists was to convince the administration that Israel was a strategic ally of the United States in forestalling the advances of the Soviet Union into the Middle East. And Dulles, they knew, looked at everything through a Cold War prism. Except his conclusion was that the U.S. had to cultivate better relations with the Arabs. So whereas Truman and most presidents since, Obama's an outlier in that, most presidents have championed what they call a special relationship with Israel, Eisenhower's policy towards Israel was what he called friendly impartiality. And even that would be challenged by the Sinai campaign. Eisenhower had no Jews in his cabinet, but he did have Jewish supporters, some of whom became quite prominent. Arthur Burns was a friend, later became Nixon's economic advisor. Phil Klutznik, who was the head of B'nai B'rith, became Carter's Secretary of Commerce. Louis Strauss served on the Atomic Energy Commission, was nominated by Ike to be Secretary of Commerce in 1959 and was rejected by the Senate in a close vote. The only Jew ever rejected for a cabinet post, although he served for a year as the interim secretary. And Max Fisher was a longtime Republican donor. But few Jews, if any, had access to Eisenhower's foreign policy inner circle. And because he wasn't a politician, and don't underestimate this, Eisenhower had never experienced Jewish pressure, Jewish lobbying, even having to solicit the Jewish vote. Personally, he was opposed to Truman's recognition of Israel, which he felt would upset America's relations with the Arabs. Once it was done, he told Klutznik, we'll have to live with it. But the anti-Zionist American Council for Judaism was the go-to organization at the time. And Dulles loved the ACJ because it suited his nefarious purposes. You can't be accused of hating Jews if you have Jews and a Jewish organization in your corner. A forerunner to the President's Conference actually met in 1955 under the auspices of Abba Ibn, who was ambassador here at the time, in order to counterbalance the ACJ. It was Ibn who saw, if the ACJ has a consistent message, you can't have another 30, 40 organizations with inconsistent messages, and that's how it was created. And in time, really a short time, the ACJ's influence would wane. Also, the Zionist rabbis were all Democrats, except for Abba Hillel Silver, who was a Republican, but he had supported Taft in 1952. It was a bad choice in any event. Taft died in 1953. Nonetheless, Eisenhower did ask Silver to deliver an invocation at his inauguration, which he did, I suppose there being no other Republican rabbis on the continent at the time. Now, much of what follows is based on an article in a book written by Queens College professor Isaac Alteris, who makes the point that Ike's Jews probably told him that most American Jews are non-Zionist, and he just understood that to mean anti-Zionist. But really meant non-Zionist. It wouldn't have mattered. And here's a good story. It's a good story for Pesach. In 1954, Ben-Gurion was prime minister. He traveled to the U.S. to meet with Eisenhower to request assistance and support in the early and difficult days of the State of Israel. So he met with Dulles, John Foster, and Dulles confronted Ben-Gurion and challenged him as follows. He said, "Tell me, Mr. Prime Minister, who do you and your state represent? Does it represent the Jews of Poland? Perhaps Yemen, Romania, Morocco, Iraq, Russia, perhaps Brazil? After 2,000 years of exile, can you honestly speak about a single nation, a single culture? Can you speak about a single heritage, or perhaps a single Jewish tradition?" Now, what he was aiming at was another target of the American administration in that day, delinking Israel from being a Jewish state. And again, you hear the same thing today as well. They didn't want it to be a Jewish state, too parochial. A Jewish state would never be able to make peace with the Arabs. And Israel in the Middle East, blending into the rest of the Middle East, could blend in, could make peace with the Arabs. Ben-Gurion answered him as follows. "Look, Mr. Secretary, approximately 300 years ago, the Mayflower set sail from England, and on it were the first settlers who settled in what would become the largest democratic superpower known as the United States of America." So Ben-Gurion said, "Now, do me a favor. Go out into the street and find 10 American children and ask them the following. What was the name of the captain of the Mayflower? How long did the voyage take? What did the people on the ship eat? What were the conditions of sailing during the voyage? I'm sure you'd agree with me that there's a good chance you won't get a good answer to these questions. Now contrast, not 300, but more than 3,000 years ago, the Jews left the land of Egypt. I would kindly request for you, Mr. Secretary, on one of your trips around the world, try and meet 10 Jewish children in different countries and ask them, what was the name of the leader who took the Jews out of Egypt? How long did it take them before they got to the land of Israel? What did they eat during the period they were wandering in the desert? And what happened to the sea when they encountered it? Once you get the answers to these questions, please carefully reconsider the question you've just asked me." Mm-hmm. Well, they just could not get it. And Israel was still a new country. The Jewish lobby, such as it existed, could not persuade Eisenhower to sell arms to Israel, and Eisenhower had an interest in barring all arms sales to the region. At the same time, State Department was already maneuvering towards a peace process eerily similar to the next 60 years, including today. In 1953, they're urging Israel, to accept some Arab refugees back, internationalize Yerushalayim, withdraw from the land they conquered in 1948 to the partition lines, all in order to placate the Arabs, and all, of course, failing, because the Arabs could not be placated then or now. Dulles felt strongly, as did Eisenhower, that Israel's survival required peace with the Arabs at any cost, whatever they wanted. It was not to be. And the real fallout came as a result of the Sinai campaign in 1956, smack in the middle of the American election season, in fact, 10 days before. And this engendered the first real crisis in America-Israel relations since 1948. We know Israel's always done well as a victim, and especially as an underdog. So years of Fedayeen raids from Egypt on Israeli settlements, the occasional retaliation, that satisfied the victim aspect. But by 1956, Israel had enough of those raids and the casualties and Nasser's constant threat of all-out war. There was a strange convergence of interests between Israel and France and Britain in 1956. When the U.S. refused to sell arms to anyone in the Middle East, Nasser of Egypt turned to the Soviet bloc. When he received weapons, Dulles was so enraged that he reneged on a deal wherein the U.S. would fund construction of the Aswan Dam in Egypt. Nasser, who was now also enraged, decided to nationalize the Suez Canal, which was built by France, managed by France and the UK. Nasser then also closed the Straits of Tiran to Israeli shipping. This blockade was an act of war. The plan was Israel would attack, seize the Sinai and the Suez Canal, and then the British and French would enter militarily to, so to speak, restore stability. The plan worked. Mivtza Kadesh, IDF invaded October 29th, 1956. The British and French began bombing targets on November 1st. Within a week, Israel had advanced the canal. The mission was accomplished. October 29th, this was a week before the presidential election, Eisenhower was furious at Israel, at France, at Britain, and in no particular order. He demanded an immediate and complete withdrawal. Israel refused. Ben-Gurion said in the Knesset, November 7th, "We will never withdraw from Sinai." You should be cautious what you say when you use the word never. A UN resolution demanding withdrawal was vetoed. Security Council vetoed by Britain and France. At the same time, the very same week, the Hungarian Revolution had started. Within weeks, the Soviets had sent 200,000 troops and 4,000 tanks to Budapest to restore communist control. The day before Election Day, the Soviets threatened to send troops to Egypt to fight the tripartite alliance. They didn't. America said if they did, America would have to respond. Under U.S. pressure, they pressured the British and the French. Divestment of British bonds, among other things. And Britain still owed America money from World War II. France and Britain agreed to withdraw. Israel still refused on principle, and then refused until it received security guarantees that Metzarei Tiran, the Straits of Tiran, will be open to Israeli shipping. Eisenhower and Dulles were furious at Israel's obstinacy. Eisenhower blamed Ben-Gurion, writing that Israel assumed that in the attack because they assume that America will acquiesce because of the Jewish vote in the elections. And he wrote to Ben-Gurion, "Despite the present temporary interests that Israel has in common with France and Britain, you ought not to forget that the strength of Israel and her future are bound up with the United States." Threats were fast in coming over the next few months, including the threat to remove the tax-exempt status of the UJA, which had raised already $500 million for Israel since 1948. Think about it. It's a little strange. People don't know about it. But why, if you give money to a Jewish organization that's going to spend it in Israel, why should that be subsidized by the American government? That's an allowance that started in the Truman's time for American Jews. I'm not so sure other countries in the world have such a thing. Well, probably now they do, but certainly then they didn't. He said, you take away the tax deductibility of those contributions. He threatened to cut off all aid, even threatened to block the shipment of oil to Israel. Jewish groups in America were divided. at first supporting Israel's right of self-defense, but then a little warier when it became clear that this was a coordinated attack with Britain and France. Most Jewish groups then just urged there be an end to hostilities and peace negotiations. One of the few groups that was outspokenly pro-Zionist was the ZOA. Abba Hill-Silver chided Dulles that he had done nothing when Mitzray Tiran were closed to Israeli shipping. He refused to sell arms to Israel, so who is he to lecture anybody? In February 1957, Dulles announced that the U.S. would consider sanctions against Israel if Israel did not withdraw, and he threatened to introduce such a resolution in the United Nations. Rabbinical groups and the new President's Conference publicly protested the sanctions. Rallies were held. The White House was bombarded with 100,000 telegrams, and public opinion shifted in favor of Israel. There was a Senate resolution condemning the administration. People named Javits and Humphrey were leaders. The majority leader, Lyndon Baines Johnson, strongly protested American policy to Eisenhower. Dulles was not happy, and he complained in his way, I quote, "It is almost impossible in this country to carry out a foreign policy not approved by the Jews." Marshall Forrestal learned that, his two predecessors, one state, one defense. "I'm going to try and have one." It was Louis Strauss who toned him down and brought Dulles around to step back from the brink. Israel now looked for a face-saver, and it came in the form of an American declaration that declared the Straits of Tiran an international waterway and that the U.S. would guarantee safe passage of Israeli ships. On March 1st, 1957, Golda Meir announced in the UN that Israel would withdraw from Sinai, and it did. On March 16th, UN peacekeepers were sent to the Israel-Sinai border, Israel-Egypt border. A lot of good that did. When the straits were closed again to Israeli shipping in May 1967, and the Prime Minister, Levi Eshkol, asked that the U.S. enforce its guarantee to Israel of free passage, he was told that the U.S. cannot find a copy of that guarantee in its archives. So much for guarantees. Years later, Max Fischer, by then was the head of the UJA, he wrote that in August 1967, after the Six-Day War, Eisenhower told him, I quote, "You know, Max, looking back at Suez, I regret what I did. I should never have pressured Israel to evacuate the Sinai. If I'd had a Jewish advisor working for me, I would not have forced the Israelis back." I don't know if the story is true. It's self-serving both for Fisher and for Eisenhower. Who knows? In truth, though, Nixon, in his memoirs, confirmed that Eisenhower, to him, said he thought he made a mistake. Well, the 1956 election took place during the Sinai campaign. Eisenhower considered dumping Nixon as vice president and suggested he might want to gain experience in a cabinet position. Nixon did not take the bait. He was as cagey as Ike. So Eisenhower suggested he take another position, and Nixon responded, he'd be honored to continue serving as vice president. And that ended that, although Eisenhower suffered a heart attack during the campaign, a serious one, that made his choice as running mate even more pressing. In the election, Eisenhower defeated Stevenson again, and by an even larger margin than in 1952. Stevenson's running mate was Estes Kefauver, who just beat out for the vice presidential nomination a young senator named John F. Kennedy. And despite Eisenhower's heavy-handedness towards Israel, he gained an even higher percentage of the Jewish vote in 1956 than he did in 1952, winning 40% of the Jewish vote to Stevenson's 60, lending some credence to his contention that the number of Zionist Jews was somewhat exaggerated. And think about this, no Republican has received as much as 40% of the Jewish vote since then. Not Reagan, not Bush II, not any Republican president deemed friendly to Israel. Eisenhower has that record going back already now since 1920. 40%, the only Republican to get 40% of the Jewish vote, 1956. Go figure. And Jews continued to honor him. By 1958, relations with Israel were back to normal. The U.S. sold guns and radar equipment to Israel in the late 50s, and they secretly gave Israel the money to buy British tanks. 1959, JTS presented Eisenhower with the by now standard Sefer Torah. Eisenhower saw himself as a progressive conservative or a moderate Republican, but it was his force of personality and the prestige earned winning World War II that gave him his real mandate and maintained his popularity. And this happened even though he engaged in some actions that were very questionable by modern standards. One has been in the news recently. It was called Operation Wetback. In 1954, and for several years thereafter, the U.S. rounded up over a million illegal illegal aliens, and deported them all back to Mexico. Inspiration, of course, for Donald Trump. Hark, the world has changed. You can't even use the term wetback anymore, but that's a slur, but that was what they called the program. And Eisenhower refused to directly take on Joe McCarthy. He allowed him to self-destruct. But he also permitted Robert Oppenheimer, the atomic scientist, to have a security clearance revoked. This in response to an investigation conducted by Louis Strauss because of Oppenheimer's admitted communist associations. And because it was Strauss who got Oppenheimer fired, in essence, Strauss was rejected by the Senate as Secretary of Commerce. But in another act that Eisenhower also claimed later to regret, he appointed Earl Warren as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and the Warren Court enshrined a host of liberal policies that transformed American civic life and changed America morally as well. Eisenhower's great failing was that he could never bring himself to speak about the state of Israel in the warm, even biblical sense that Truman did, nor to ever speak of Israel as a strategic ally. Tim, Israel was always a ward. He was sympathetic to the story, to the narrative, but a ward, a beneficiary, a victim who should not have independent thoughts and certainly not challenge American foreign policy. He was, though, very impressed with Israel's military, both in 1956 and 1967. In 1957, in the address, radio address, which he called for Israel's withdrawal from Sinai, he said, "The people of Israel, like those of the United States, are imbued with a religious faith and a sense of moral values." And a year later, 58, in a Yom Ha'aretz message to the Jews, he said, and I quote, "The teaching of their ancient belief is filled with truth for the present day. Its profound sense of justice, nation to nation, man to man, is an essential part of every religious and social order. The health of our society depends upon a deep and abiding respect for the basic commandments of the God of Israel." In his later years, Eisenhower lived in Gettysburg, where his home, not far from the great battlefield, is today a museum about his life and presidency. He died March 28th, 1969, just a little over 2 months after Nixon became the president, age 78, and he was buried back home in Abilene, Kansas. Relations between the U.S. and Israel were still undergoing growing pains during the 1950s. The 1960s, a tumultuous decade in many respects, would see Israel redefine itself and its relationship with America, and a more prominent role for Jews in the administrations of John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Baines Johnson. And that we will hold for next time. My good friends, we next meet after Pesach. All right? The wedding next Monday. So we meet again after Pesach. Chakosh Mech and all will resume looking at the presidencies of Kennedy and Johnson in one fell swoop. I thank you all very much.